Well, thanks very much for your patience. I know we're getting started a little bit late, but we want to make sure we had an opportunity to get everybody in here. I do have to tell you, and I know not everybody is from the Britton area, but this is a heck of a facility. This is a very, very nice location for this meeting, so it's quite an asset to the community. Thanks for allowing us to use it. Before we get started here with the formal meeting, we'll go ahead and do some introductions. My name is Dusty Johnson, and I serve as the chairman of the Public Utilities Commission this year. My colleagues Gary Hansen and Steve Kolbeck are also here, and we work for you. We are elected statewide and are happy to be a part of this process. We've also got up here at this table with us John Smith, who serves as the commission's general counsel, which means he keeps us out of jail. Down here we've got Greg Rizlov, who serves acts as the commission's advisor, which means he makes sure we do the right things. So that's our team. We do have TransCanada. We'll have some introductions by the applicant a little bit later. I also want to make sure that you know the commission staff. And the commission staff is focused on the same thing that we do. They're just working independently. They're interested in the public interest, and at the end of this process, they're going to provide a recommendation to the commissioner sitting up here. And so we'll start. We've got Nathan Solem back over there. We've got Kara Van Bakkern, who is right there. We've got Martin Bettman. And we've got Bob Knadel. And oh, there's Martin over there, and there's Bob right there. So these guys will spend hundreds and maybe thousands of hours working on this over the course of the next few months, so we certainly appreciate their efforts. All right, let's go ahead and get started. Now, unfortunately, the first 3 or 4 minutes is going to be some legal stuff we've got to read to get onto the record, so bear with us here. We will now begin the public input hearing for HP 07-001, and that's the docket that deals with the application by TransCanada for a permit under the South Dakota Energy Conversion and Transmission Facility Act to construct the Keystone Pipeline Project. The date is, I believe, June 27th, and the time is a little bit after noon, and we are here in Britton, South Dakota. Now, the purpose of this hearing is really twofold. First, it is to provide the public some additional information about this project, and that's the burden of the applicant today, to tell you a little bit more. And hopefully their presentation will answer some of the questions you've got, and it will probably also likely raise other questions in your mind, which we will have an opportunity to get answered a little bit later. The second purpose is really for you all to ask questions of the applicant, or also to make comments, mention concerns, mention support of the project, whatever you like, and mention that to the commissioners so that we can make sure that your thoughts are a part of our process as we move forward. A copy of the application is on file with the Marshall, Day, Clark, Beadle, Kingsbury, Miner, Hansen, McCook, Hutchinson, and Yankton County Auditors. And any of you can also go access our website, which has a lot of information, hundreds of pages of the application at www.puc.sd.gov. And if you want to know exactly how to navigate that site so that you can get to the information, grab any one of us, and we'd be happy to make sure you get there. Now, the parties to the proceeding at this time are the applicant, the commission, and numerous other interested persons who have requested and been granted party status. Under South Dakota law, each municipality, county, and governmental agency in the area where the facility is proposed to be constructed, or any interested person or entity, may be granted party status in this proceeding by making a written application to the commission on or before July 10th, which I believe is about 2 weeks from now. And some people will have questions about what is party status. Well, let me back up a little bit and say that what I suspect most of you here want to do is get your questions answered, or make comments on the record so that there are things we can consider as a part of this process. If that's what you want to do, you don't need to do anything special. At any point during this process, not just today and not just this month, but at any point, really almost up until the time when we render our decision, if you send us a letter or an email, we'll make sure that that gets entered into the record. That'll be something we'll use to consider this application. Now, some people, they want to do more legally than just have their voice heard. They maybe want to introduce evidence. Maybe they want to cross-examine witnesses. Maybe they want to issue discovery requests. Maybe they want to be able to raise objections at a very formal part of the process we may have coming later. If that's the case, if you really want to be a player in the courtroom type proceeding, then you may want to become an intervener. And that is just called requesting party status. We do have forms here in case you want to do that. We have had I would guess upwards of 140 people apply for party status already. Some of them may not want to be in that deep. If you're one of those people, just let us know and we'll have a conversation about whether or not you want to be an interested person or you want to have a more formal legal role in the proceedings to come. For its permit to be approved, the applicant must show that the proposed pipeline will comply with all applicable laws and rules, that the pipeline will not pose a threat of serious injury to the environment or to the social and economic condition of inhabitants or expected inhabitants within the siting area. Additionally, that the pipeline will not substantially impair the health, safety, or welfare of the inhabitants, and that the pipeline will not unduly interfere with the orderly development of the region, with due consideration having been given to the view of governing bodies in this area. Based on these factors, this commission will decide whether the permit for the project should be granted, denied, or granted upon such terms, conditions, or modifications of the construction, operation, or maintenance of the facilities as the commission finds appropriate. We're going to start today by having the applicant make a presentation, and we've asked them to keep it to 45 minutes to provide some information to all of us. Following that presentation, we're going to take comments from any interested persons, and we do want to encourage landowners and other interested people here today to present your views. And as I mentioned, you can also submit your views in writing. With that, I'll pause to see if my colleagues have noticed anything I've forgotten. And if there's nothing else preliminarily, then we will look to Mr. Brett Kennecke, who serves as an attorney representing TransCanada in this matter. Mr. Kennecke, go ahead.
Thank you, Commissioner. My name is Brett Kennecke. I'm a lawyer from Peer, and I represent TransCanada in this proceeding. As Commissioner Johnson said, we'll have a presentation of about 45 minutes, during which the three gentlemen to my right will try to present information which is designed to explain to you a lot more in detail about the project than I myself can do. And I'll look forward to each of you guys holding me under the time limit again. I'll be doing my best to give you your cues. This is Robert Jones to my right. He's a vice president at TransCanada responsible for the Keystone project. Mike Koski is an engineer from Florida and has overall project responsibilities and is a consultant on the project. And then to his right is Buster Gray, an engineer from Kansas City and also Houston, Texas, and he has specific responsibility for design and construction. Seated behind them are several people with specific areas of technical expertise, and we are going to try to band together as a team to do our best to answer any and all questions which you might have about any facet or phase of the project. We look forward to engaging with you in the dialogue here this afternoon. And with that, I'll turn it over to Robert Jones. Thank you for coming.
Mr. Jones, just a minute. Let's do a quick mic check. Raise your hand if you can't hear me. Did anybody have any problem hearing Mr. Kennecke? A little bit. Maybe if we could just get that wireless mic. If we could make sure that wireless mic stays pretty close to the mouth, that'd be great.
Certainly. Can everybody hear me? Oh, yeah, I can hear me. Is it too loud? I'll try. Is this better if I hold it down here? All right. I don't want to sound like I'm shouting at anybody. Well, they took the podium away, so I'm going to have to carry around my notes with me just so I don't forget anything. Maybe. Just hold on a minute. How's that? Can everybody still see the screen and I can keep my notes here? Good. Well, thank you very much for coming. It is a gorgeous day and it's a pleasure to be here. I just enjoyed the drive this morning. It was just a gorgeous morning. The objective of this presentation for me is to inform you that TransCanada leads the industry in the design, construction, and operation of oil pipelines and pipelines of all kinds. And what I'm hoping we can do today is answer your concerns and answer your questions and be as responsive as possible. First, I'd like to just briefly tell you a little bit about TransCanada. We are a leading energy infrastructure company, and we have about $24 billion worth of assets throughout North America, and we've been in operation for over 50 years. TransCanada is not an oil company. We don't own the oil. and we are not an oil company of any kind. Sorry, I got to try and get this monitored correctly here. Thank you for that. Keystone is a utility, and we will be providing a public service, and we will be providing that service in the public interest. TransCanada has over 36,500 miles of pipelines in North America. And associated with these pipelines, we have relationships with over 40,000 landowners. Most of those pipelines, the majority of those pipelines, are operated here in the United States. We have offices throughout the United States. We have offices in Oregon, Illinois, Buster's located in Kansas City. We have an office in Nebraska. Houston is our U.S. head office. We have offices throughout U.S. Northeast, Michigan, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York. So why Keystone? Why is there a crude oil pipeline planned to be built in South Dakota? The reason there's Keystone is because in Canada, there's over 175 billion barrels of proven oil reserves and potentially up to 300 billion barrels of oil reserves in northern Alberta. This is the second largest oil reserve in the world, as you can see by this graph. The number one country with oil reserves is Saudi Arabia. And five of the top six countries with oil reserves are in the Middle East. Following that is Venezuela. Canada is today the largest exporter of oil to the United States. Approximately 2 million barrels of oil every single day is pipelined into the United States. The next following Canada would be Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Mexico. And they all export approximately a million barrels each. Saudi Arabia, slightly more than a million barrels. The U.S. economy every single day consumes 20 million barrels of oil. And the U.S. production is declining at a rate of about 5%. So Keystone is the conduit that's going to connect this very reliable offshore source of crude from a country that has very similar laws and rules and values to this country. And it's going to connect this very, very secure reserve into refineries in the Midwest. And these refineries, whether they be in Illinois or in Oklahoma, which are the closest refineries to South Dakota, provide the materials that we use every day. For example, we need gasoline for our cars. We need diesel for our trucks, fertilizers, aviation fuel, and, of course, asphalt for the roads. These are all products that come out of refineries that we use every day here in South Dakota. One point I forgot to mention was the production in Alberta. I said that there's 2 million barrels of oil every day that's pipelined in the United States from Canada. The oil sands production is forecasted to grow to 3 million barrels by the year 2015. And so that provides us the opportunity to move this additional production into the U.S. Commercial support. TransCanada received commercial support for the Keystone project when we had an open season. We went out to the marketplace and we requested long-term contracts. And energy companies signed binding contracts. The average term of those contracts was 18 years and the volume was 340,000 barrels. So of the initial capacity of 435,000 barrels, 340,000 barrels of that capacity is signed up with long-term contracts, most of it over 18 years, and that is to supply the refineries, as I said, in Illinois and in the future in Oklahoma. Again, TransCanada doesn't own the oil. I've been using the analogy that we are the trucker. We don't find oil, we don't sell oil, and we don't own the oil. We ship the oil, so we're very much like a trucking company. You may have heard recently an announcement about a potential refinery. I want to assure you that Keystone has nothing to do with that refinery. That's a potential announcement, and Keystone has binding contracts to supply other refineries in the U.S., ones that already exist. So let me describe the project. Like any good Canadian, this pipeline is shaped like a hockey stick. The first part of the pipeline is the blade. It is conversion of 500 miles of existing natural gas pipeline. So this existing natural gas pipeline is going to be converted to oil service, and that's why we start at Winnipeg. The shaft of the hockey stick would then be a direct shot to Cushing. And this is the 1,082 miles that will be constructed in the United States. And the diameter of the pipeline is 30 inches. And the pressure, the maximum operating pressure of this pipeline is 1,440 psi. In order to move the oil, we need to use electrical-driven pumps. And those pumps are spaced every 50 miles along the right-of-way. Keystone will be regulated and reviewed by a number of federal and state agencies. And in order to construct this pipeline, we need to get a presidential permit because we cross an international border. The agency in Washington to issue the presidential permit is the Department of State. As part of their process under the National Environmental Policy Act, they need to issue an environmental impact statement, and they're the lead agency to prepare that that environmental impact statement. This project will also be reviewed by the Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Department of Transportation in Washington, and the offices throughout the United States. In South Dakota, the Energy Conservation and Transmission Facilities Act, authorizing siting and construction of this project, is why we're here today, and that's why the commission is here, and this is why this hearing is commencing today. Other South Dakota agencies that have a role in reviewing this project are the Department of Environment and Natural Resources and also the Department of State Historic Preservation Office. We've been working on regulatory approvals for almost 2 years, and we're hoping to have all our permits in place so we can start construction in the spring of 2008 so that the pipeline can be constructed and built by the fourth quarter of 2009. The benefits to South Dakota. So during construction, we're going to construct approximately $300 million worth of assets in the state. And those construction workers are going to need to have food and lodging as they go down the pipeline. There will also be four pump stations, so there'll be a number of workers that'll be working at a site for over 2 years. The contractors will need to use local businesses to get services such as parts and equipment, supplies of sand and gravel and aggregate, and those are just examples. But the main long-term economic benefit will be the taxes that Keystone will pay, and those taxes are based on the value of the asset. We estimate that Keystone in its first year will pay $6.5 million to counties and school districts along the right-of-way. In addition to those property taxes, we're also going to pay sales and contractor excise tax. And again, that goes directly to the state. There will also be some permanent jobs and temporary jobs. The permanent jobs to operate four pump stations, these remote stations, are two journeyman electricians and a journeyman pipeliner, but we also need 50 to 60 contract staff to assist in the operation and maintenance and for emergency response. I'm now going to ask Mr. Mike Koski to talk to you about route selection and environmental impact.
Thank you, Robert. I'd like to thank everybody for coming out today. I'd like to thank the commission and commission staff. I'm just going to give a quick summary of route selection and environmental impact assessment that's gone on for the project. The project as proposed in South Dakota involves approximately 220 miles of 30-inch pipeline, four pump stations, and 15 mainline valves. The route selection process that was used to arrive at that project route that I just showed you involves a number of iterations and steps kind of summarized here, and I'll go through these, what they mean. The first step is to identify the project objectives. what it is we want the project to accomplish. And in this case, it is to take crude oil in northern Alberta and move it to refineries in the U.S. Initial market deliveries for the project involved deliveries in Missouri and Illinois, and that later evolved to include deliveries in Illinois and Oklahoma, dropping delivery points in Missouri. Based on those objectives, one other important aspect of this particular project, which is unique, is an objective involved the maximizing the use of an existing gas pipeline in Canada, converting it to oil to reduce the overall length of the project. Once the objectives are identified, we establish control points. Obviously, the start of the project is a control point. Where it has to go is a control point. And there's other locations in the middle, such as major river crossings, that largely fix where we go. Based on these control points, we connect the dots and begin a series of studies. We gather maps, aerial photography, environmental data, and we establish constraints and opportunities. Now, constraints are areas that we want to avoid or minimize, such as national parks or extensive wet areas, areas of poor soils. And opportunities tend to be existing linear facilities that we like to follow. The preferred utilities that we follow are existing pipelines or power lines. There's quite a few pipelines in South Dakota already, but unfortunately none of them go in the direction that we need to go. We do locate with some in a few places where we can, such as most notably at the Missouri River crossing. Based on these constraints and opportunities, we establish a series of alternatives, and then a group of engineers, environmental resources, biologists, and construction experts review these alternatives and establish a preferred option. We then take that option and we conduct open houses. We solicit the public's input on these routing alternatives. We gather more data through that, and we also canvass the agencies, federal and state agencies, to gather even more data. And we take all that information and circle back through the process to continue to refine that. And this has occurred over the course of approximately two years for this project. Now, we certainly heard suggestions lately that we should be looking at I-29 as a possible feature. And at first thought, this seems to make a lot of sense. It is going north and south generally, and we're going north and south generally. It doesn't go exactly where we need to go, but we did look at it. There's basically two ways I-29 could have been utilized. You could either be within the right-of-way or adjacent to it. Problems with being within the right-of-way are we encounter frequent interchanges and overpasses, which we must go around, and this puts the line back on private land and increases the length of the route. Also, highway departments don't want us in there, in both North Dakota and South Dakota. That is not something that's consistent with highway department policy. It serves as an impediment to their maintenance activities and expansion activities, and construction certainly poses a safety risk to motorists and to our own construction workers. Now, routing adjacent to I-29 alleviates those problems except for one big one, and that is you still have all the towns and cities that are located along the interstate. You have all the interchanges and overpasses still, which we must go around, and that overall increases the length and the impact of the project. Now, I mentioned we considered this option, and it was considered very early in the process when we were going to delivery points in Missouri and Illinois. But as I mentioned, that the project objectives evolved, dropping Missouri and adding Illinois, or involving just Illinois and Oklahoma. That then forced the project to go further south before it would head east so we could access Oklahoma. That necessitated a crossing of the Missouri River. Now, the Missouri River is a fairly large river. You can't cross it everywhere. We did an extensive study of that river and landed on Yankton, South Dakota as the preferred crossing location. And that crossing is adjacent to two existing pipeline crossings, as well as a highway bridge. And the river is relatively narrow at that point and restrained. It's not moving around laterally like many other parts of the river. So all of these, with the utilizing the existing pipeline in Canada, we have a crossing point approximately 35 miles east of or west of I-29. The crossing at Yankton puts us about 30 miles west of I-29. So the whole project is west of I-29, and it's awkward to come back to it because we'd have to then deviate away from it again. Now, the environmental review for the project, as Robert mentioned, we are going through a NEPA review led by the Department of State as the lead federal agency. There are multiple other federal agencies involved, and we have submitted an extensive application involving detailed environmental information, both desktop information and extensive field surveys. Many of you have likely granted permission for our crews to come through and gather environmental data, which we have done over the course of the last year. And all of that information has also been filed in support of our South Dakota PUC application, which includes impact assessments of all the major environmental resource groups listed here. Now, a key part of our applications is what we call a construction mitigation or reclamation plan. And this plan is something that we've put together that has all of our commitments for all types of features that we cross. This has been a combination of permit conditions that we've used on previous projects that have been given to us by agencies on previous projects. And it involves all the procedures and specifications for crossing farmland, for crossing rivers, for crossing wetlands, and for reclaiming the areas once we cross them. It also includes extensive information and guidelines for our post-construction monitoring to make sure that when we put it back, it gets put back to the way it needs to be. Now, that has formed a vital part of our applications, and it will be amended to all of our approvals and will be commitments that Keystone must follow during construction. With that, I'll pass this on to Buster Gray. He's going to talk about the land acquisition process and construction.
Good afternoon. Certainly, I was here in the area about 4 to 6 weeks ago, I believe, and I recognize a number of faces, certainly from that meeting. So hopefully you'll find some of this not completely redundant with the previous meeting. But as we've discussed, and I know the slide's difficult to see, but we're seeking to acquire a 110-foot construction right-of-way typically. That's comprised of a 50-foot permanent easement and a 60-foot construction workspace or temporary easement, as we call it sometimes. Additionally, when we cross roads, rivers, streams, topographical features that we need to dig bigger holes, that we need additional space to store spoil on, you'll be talked about additional workspace as well, which is a temporary use. We started our negotiations on right-of-way about 2 months ago. You may or may not have been contacted in those 2 months. If you have not been, here within the next 4 to 6 weeks, everyone should be contacted that we would be negotiating to acquire an easement from. The compensation package that the company is putting forward is to pay fair market value for the permanent easement. It's to pay 50% of fair market value for the workspace or temporary easement, and it is to pay 100% of crop loss for the year of construction. And when I say crop loss, that is 100% of the yield for the acreage for the particular crop that's being taken off. We will pay a 75% crop loss for the year following construction, or we call it the second year, and then we will pay a 50% crop loss for the third year. The diminishing damage payment is it's our belief after a third year that that your land will return to its former productivity by that period of time. But if it does not, for whatever reason, the damages and the responsibilities of crop loss stay with the pipeline company, until such time that we can restore it to its former productivity. The key point that I would make and would like for you to consider in the fair market offer is we are offering that for that permanent easement as if we were buying the land in fee. But we're taking the easement. We return the land to you for its production of farming or grazing, with some limited rights about your ability to build structures or other things which are stated in the easement. Other thing on this slide, and I know these numbers, but it should be in the literature. Our South Dakota land supervisor is Tim Slorby. Our office is located in Huron, South Dakota. Should you have some issues with an agent or things, you're welcome to contact Mr. Slorby. Denny Needham is my land manager in Kansas City. There's a number on the literature for him as well. If you're not satisfied at that level, certainly contact Mr. Needham. Also here, and I'll ask Sandy if she'll hold her hand up, from TransCanada, a TransCanada land representative that is here. Should you have any issues relative to the conduct of our agents, if you feel like you're being strong-armed, if you just think you're not being dealt with fairly or with respect, you're welcome to contact these folks, and we will investigate and try and resolve the issue. Secondly, I think as I mentioned at the other meeting, you're welcome to contact myself also. This graphic represents a pipeline construction spread of how we construct a pipeline project. And again, I know the difficulty of the slide in viewing, but if you start at this end where we start our surveying and clearing operations, as you wind around the picture of the various crews till you get back to what we call the lowering in and the backfilling and the cleanup and the testing, it's essentially assembly line by which crews move down the right-of-way. We start at one end and go to the other, and these crews work one behind the other, much like an assembly line of an automobile plant, other than, in our instance, the product stays stationary and the people move, where at an automobile plant, the people stay stationary and the cars go by. This particular construction spread in this example, typically from this end to the back end, I would estimate about 50 to 60 miles. It's certainly weather dependent. The crews will move at a pace of about 1.25 to 1.5 miles per day. Landowners are very interested. We believe we will impact your land about 8 to 12 weeks. And this construction crew is, or contractor and all, is made up of about 350 to 450 workers. The next series of slides are just some selected photographs of that assembly line. And certainly in the Midwest, one of the things that we're most concerned about is restoration of the land to its former use, be it agriculture or grazing. Topsoil removal is one of those mitigation methods that's utilized where we remove the topsoil to perform our work and we return it at the completion of construction. These slides represent we will stockpile pipe along the pipeline route. I would guess it's somewhere around 30 to 40 mile intervals. Pipe will be hauled from those pipe yards to the right-of-way, put along the right-of-way. We call that stringing in our business. And the pipeline will have to be bent for horizontal turns or topography. We literally have to bend the pipe to fit the topography of the earth, and that's done with hydraulic machines. The trenching operations are done by two methods, even a large wheel trencher that's shown, I guess, on your left, and or a backhoe-type trench, which most folks are familiar with. And contractors have the options of those methods, but I believe the southern part of the state will probably be dug with the wheel trencher, where in this area north, as it appears to me to be wetter, would probably be dug with backhoes. The next operation of joining the pipe, we use both methods of a manual or stick electrode welding, or we use automatic welding, which is welding with machines in it. And those two technologies that are utilized are inspected either by radiographic or X-ray inspection or with ultrasonic inspection to ensure the quality of the welds. Once the pipes welded together, the field joint or the area of the weld, that comes bare to the right-of-way without a coating on the pipe, in which we apply either a spray-applied or brush-applied coating to that joint. But prior to the pipe being lowered in the trench, we have a device called a holiday detector or a Jeep that you run along the pipe that if there is a nick or damage in the coating, it will make a sound, and it sounds like a Jeep sound, and that place will be repaired prior to the pipe being picked up and lowered and put in the trench. The next operation is backfilling, and we call padding. If we have material that's very rocky or angular or granular material, we will run some machines that will select fines to put around the pipe prior to putting the other material back in. The key item here is, unless there's something very unique, the material that comes out of the trench is the material that goes back in. I talked about the topsoil replacement, and I think with this slide, just with the topsoil off, we bring it back to the best of our ability to the depths and the contours that existed prior to construction. Foreign utility or other utility crossings, anytime you build a linear project that's 1,000 miles long, you literally cross hundreds of utilities, be it water lines, other pipelines, electric utilities, not just public utilities, but private as well. Your water lines, your electric lines, and we have to go through an extensive effort to locate those, work with the existing owners of those to cross them. We typically cross beneath them because of the depth of cover we desire. Most utilities, we cannot get over and maintain the cover. So literally, we will go underneath most utilities. The separation requirement in our codes is 12 inches. And a lot of folks, with your frost depths here and the depths of things, you say, well, that's a big hole. It is a big hole. But we do typically cross beneath. Road crossings, when I say certainly all paved roads, all well-maintained, gravel or surface roads, well-traveled or bored. In the Dakotas, I've done a good bit of work in North Dakota in my career. There are a lot of what I call two-track roads that are really not maintained. We might would ask you to open cut those, but again, as your authority for managing your roads, you have a lot of authority in dictating to us the methods by which we cross your roads. The pipelines fill with water once it's completed. The water is taken permitted from streams and rivers to fill it with water. The pipeline is tested to 125% of its maximum operating pressure, and these records are required to be maintained for the life of the pipeline. Upon completion, we also run a device called a caliper pig. It's simply a geometry tool that will run through the pipeline to determine if there's been any damage to the pipe during our transportation or construction of the pipeline, be it a dent or a buckle that might have occurred. If a defect was determined, it would be removed prior to putting the pipeline in service. The next three slides, and just to emphasize mitigation techniques for returning the land, the top left-hand corner representing compaction. One of the issues we deal with is with our heavy equipment compacting the land and relieving that compaction after we construct. And we use ripping tools and subsoiling tools, much like you utilize, to do that. We take a measurement on the right-of-way and a measurement off the right-of-way of compaction to ensure that we return the right-of-way to the compaction level of the adjacent fields. Rock picking. Up in the Midwest with the glacial till or cobble, we will remove either by mechanical pickers or hand picking the rock to a density and size comparable or better than the adjacent field that we are on the right of way. And then in non-aquacultural areas in particular, getting a ground cover back would be at winter rye or something. So with heavy rains and erosion, the sooner we can get something growing back, the less likely we are for erosion. This last slide is just a before and after photograph of construction and then after, and hopefully you can see. And the main purpose of this slide is we're not here to tell you we can put the land back exactly like it was prior to construction. It's literally impossible. We will put it back to the best of our ability, and we will put it back to its former use and productivity. And we're confident through experience in building pipelines over the years that we can do that. With that,
thanks, Buster. How are we doing for time? Keystone One is subject to federal regulations and national codes. A few of these codes are shown here on this slide. These regulations are intended to protect the public and the environment and the landowner and to prevent pipeline failures. TransCanada leads the industry in best practices. Some of our design safety features are listed here. One of the most important one is depth of cover. To prevent any mechanical damage to the pipeline, code is that the pipeline, the top of the pipeline is to be 30 inches below the surface. Our best practice is to make that cover 48 inches. So we significantly exceed code there. Keystone also is going to use a high-strength steel. Steels that, again, follow the national code and standards. One of the greatest advances in technology over the last few years has been the coating. This coating that we're going to use, TransCanada has used exclusively since 1980, is a fusion bond epoxy, or FBE, coating. How this coating works is that when the pipe comes out of the mill, it is sandblasted to a pure white finish. And then it is heated, and an epoxy is sprayed on that heated, clean pipe until it fuses with the steel. This then creates a very, very strong external coating. In case we have, after construction, an anomaly that even misses the holiday detector, there is a cathodic protection, which is a redundant protection system. It's a low voltage current that is applied to the steel, and that provides a cathodic protection system. The other thing we do is we install marker signs and marker tape, and we do that in areas of crossings. So when we're crossing a highway where there is a higher than normal chance that somebody could be excavating around the pipeline, there's marker signs along the highway. You may see them as you drive by, and when you cross the pipeline, they're along the side of the road, and we will also put marker tape down. The other design feature that TransCanada has is isolation valves. These isolation valves, in the state of Dakota, there's 15 of them. They're remotely controlled, and that is to minimize any discharge in the unlikely event of a spill. TransCanada, over its 50 years of operation, has developed a quality control and a quality assurance program that begins in the mill. It begins with the fabrication of the steel into the fabrication of the pipe, the delivery of the pipe to site, and then Buster went through all the other quality control and quality assurance programs that occurred during construction. And that carries through into operations as well. One key feature I want to highlight is hydrotesting. Buster mentioned that the pipeline will be hydrotested to 1.25 times its pressure. That test is done with water, and it's only done one time, and that is to ensure that any potential anomaly or defect is discovered prior to operation. We have a computerized control center. It's called a SCADA center. It's 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. It has redundant systems, and we have a full operational backup control center as well. The scan time for the communication system is between 6 and 8 seconds, so we get full run of detail in that time period, and that also has a backup communication system as well. We also have a state-of-the-art dedicated leak detection system, and that leak detection system measures all the volumes at all the different locations throughout the system, and it measures the volume of oil coming in the line and balances it with the amount of oil leaving the line at the delivery points. Pipeline maintenance. Again, TransCanada is a leader in pipeline maintenance and research. One of the greatest advances we've had, again, over the years is computerized technology, is inline inspection. Sometimes we refer to these as smart picks. These are tools that we put in the pipeline. They have computers and sensors on them that can measure the wall thickness. So during the years, as we operate this pipeline, we are going to run the first one within 3 years, and then we're going to run a subsequent one 5 years later, and that is the code here in the United States. With the data that we get from these tools, if we find anything that is below what they call an RPR level, or rupture pressure ratio level, we will lower the pressure in the line. We will then, when we go to excavate it, stop the line, confirm that there is an anomaly, and cut that out before the pipeline's ever put back into service. The other thing we need to do is a public awareness program, make sure the public is aware where the pipeline is and the landowner is aware, because, as you know, landowners do change over time, and we'll be part of a South Dakota one-call program. Oil spill response. In the unlikely event of an oil spill, Keystone will be preparing a detailed oil spill response plan to the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. They're the office that regulates oil spill response. We'll do this prior to the commencement of operation. The spill response will include cleanup equipment that will be deployed at pre-positioned locations. And the locations will be determined by a spill analysis that's based on the worst possible case. Again, in the unlikely event that there is a leak, TransCanada is responsible for the cleanup, and that cleanup or the remediation of that area will be done in the coordination with federal legislators and the State Department of Energy and Natural Resources. That's the state of South Dakota. Keystone has worked hard to be a good neighbor in all the communities that we have a presence. We do this by respecting and considering the health and well-being and safety of our employees, our contractors, our landowners, our communities, and the environment. Now, we look forward to being a part of the community here in South Dakota. We have a number of ways you can communicate to us. We have a website. We have a 1-800 number. And Buster mentioned the landowner numbers you can contact to get a hold of us. So thank you very much. And Commissioner?
Thanks very much, Mr. Jones. In the first couple of meetings after TransCanada had a presentation, the commissioners had an opportunity to ask some questions. And so, and this I should note for those of you that don't know, this is our fourth public meeting on this docket this week. And so we really have been out attempting to, you know, get feedback from people as well as get additional information from TransCanada. At this time, the commissioners aren't going to ask any questions right now. We really want to get to your comments and questions. That doesn't mean that we won't ask some questions later on. And I should mention that this process is not a particularly short one. We're really at the beginning. There is going to be lots and lots of opportunity for evidence to be introduced in a more formal proceeding, for witnesses to come in and be sworn and provide testimony under oath. That's not really what we're doing today. This is far less formal, more of an opportunity to just get some public comment. We have Ms. Van Bakkeren. Are you going to be working the mic? Ms. Van Bakkeren is an attorney with the Public Utilities Commission. And if somebody wants to raise their hand, you know, she'll make sure you get a mic. We do have some requests, some ground rules, so that we can make sure we can hear from as many people as possible. The first is that we would ask that those people who have relatively short comments, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, or short questions, that they go first. And that way, if people have other things they need to do today, they can get their questions answered and then go. And then people who have, you know, longer presentations or information, if we could save them toward the end of this meeting, that I think would be helpful. Secondly, you know, we do have a court reporter, and as a result, I would ask that you speak loudly and clearly. If you get going too fast, she may ask you to stop and back up. And we would also ask that you mention your name and your place of residence when you first begin speaking so that we can get that for the record. Because these meetings have had a tendency to, you know, last quite, you know, a number of hours, we would just ask that you try to avoid too many repetitive questions. If a question's been asked before or if a comment's been made before, if you need to clarify the answer, go ahead. We want to make sure you get the information you need, but try to avoid too much repetition. In the past, when we've had these meetings on other citing cases, sometimes we've had people that they show up and they want to read an article into the record, or maybe a particularly long letter. And, you know, people might show up with a two-page newspaper article and they think it just might take a couple of minutes for them to read it. And it really takes a lot longer than you think it's going to. And it's not really of any use to anybody because after the first, you know, 45 seconds of reading, everybody kind of quits listening to you. And then anybody who wants that information that you read has got to go into the transcript and kind of look around for it. I think it's a lot more useful for everybody that if you've got an article or something long and written to read, give that to us. We will make sure that it gets up on the website, that it'll be a part of the official record of this, and anybody who wants to get access to that information can get it in a way that's very user-friendly. Now, when you do introduce that information to the record, we're fine with you taking a minute to sort of explain an outline of it so that we kind of know what you're introducing. Similarly, if you have any maps or diagrams or anything else, if you get those to us, we will make either today or in the future, we'll make sure that we get those entered into the record. And finally, and this has gone very well, we've just asked people, at the beginning of the week, we asked people not to make the same presentations at each of the four meetings because, again, we want to keep this efficient. We want to hear from as many of you as possible. And that really has not been much of a problem, and so we thank everybody for their cooperation there. We do have a sign-up sheet that has been circulated. If you haven't had an opportunity to sign it yet, we would really ask that you do that. Maybe just raise your hand and grab a staff member, and we can make sure that you get a sign-up sheet. All right, what have I forgotten? Yeah, because we do have a court reporter, and you know she can't type for 4 hours straight or 3 hours straight, we will periodically take short breaks so that she can get the rest she needs. They also serve another really nice purpose, and that is sometimes you all will have questions that are kind of unique to your situation. It's not the kind of thing that, you know, everybody needs to hear about, but you want to ask TransCanada a specific question. These short breaks do allow for that, as well as for any interaction you need with the commission staff or one another. Anything else I've forgotten? All right. With that, just raise your hand. Ms. Van Bakker will get that microphone.